words appear. The email addresses and groups mentioned on this program no longer exist. Blind Like Me does exist in its new incarnation on groups.io. To join, send a blank email to blindlikeme+subscribe@groups.io. That's blindlikeme+subscribe@groups.io.
Phil Parr again, coming into your homes, wherever you happen to be, no matter where, what part of the world or the country or the universe for that matter. Here we are with Blind Like Me, that's what we call our program, and Jay Williams from the, somewhere in the Northwest. Where would that be, sir?
Port Angeles, Washington.
Port Angeles, Washington. What size burg is that?
18,000, give or take.
So a little smaller than Lufkin, Texas, just a little bit. Do you have all the good restaurants? Do you have an Outback, a Chili's? Do you have the good restaurants there or not?
A few of those. We the type of restaurant, remember, we're in Washington State. This is coffee country. This is yuppie country.
Uh-huh.
And we're the off-jumping place for the ferries going to Victoria, British Columbia. So we get lots of yuppie. We get Thai food and Chinese food and all kinds of that stuff, too.
Yeah, for the ferries. I'm just wondering, because we took a ferry to Vancouver.
Oh, that would have been from east of here, from Edmonds or someplace like that.
And went up, and it was cold, and you know, I just read my book all the way. Took an hour and a half or longer, and you know, it wasn't a bad trip. It was just seemingly. And this was, it seemed like late October, but it was colder than I wanted it to be. Anyway, you weren't raised there. You said you're from Minnesota originally.
Yeah.
And so you were born in where, sir?
Rochester, Minnesota.
Rochester, Minnesota. And you were born without vision at all, or?
Yeah. Yep.
So you've been doing this a long time. This, I think you said you're 60.
I'm 63.
63. So you've been blind a good while.
Yeah. You know, I'd never thought about it, but sometimes when Kathy, who's also on the list, Kathy Seven, she's known by.
Yeah.
She's my wife. We get on the bus, and I hadn't thought of this before, but one time somebody asked her something, have you been blind all your life? And she said, no, I'm still alive.
Yeah, not, you know, have you lived here all your life? Well, not yet, I haven't, you know.
Right.
That same kind of thing. So Kathy Seven Williams is your wife.
Yep.
Yeah, because she's on the, I don't know if she's on the Blind Like Me list, but she's on the handyman list.
Yeah, she is.
I see questions and answers from her all the time.
Oh, yeah. She's quite good at that.
And likes it. Has been on there practically ever since we started the list.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be darned. Small world, isn't it, huh?
Yep.
And so you say on the bus, where would you folks traveling to work or to go?
We have a great bus system up here. And before that, though, we lived in Utah, and and we lived up in North Ogden, and we had to get anywhere. We took the bus all the time, and so you know, we got all these questions like that.
Oh, yeah. Now in Minnesota, as a small child, how would you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I had a brother and three sisters.
Brother and three sisters. Where are you in the pecking order?
Next to youngest.
Next to the youngest. Are you the only blind one?
Yep.
The only one. And how did the parents? What did they think? How did they treat you when you were little?
They let me fall down the stairs. They just figured, you know. He's got to sink or swim.
Yeah.
So they didn't overprotect or anything. They sent me off to the school for the blind when I was five.
Yeah.
And so I've been through that scene, been there, done that one.
That was only choice. You know, that
pretty
was
much back then, yeah.
Pretty much, because you say you were born, if you're 63, you were born 41, so it was 47.
Yeah.
When you went to school, that was may not have been the only choice, but it was what they, what society sort of recommended they do with you. Began teaching you Braille and.
I learned. I'm a good Braille reader. I learned at age five, and I was okay until I got introduced to Sherlock Holmes, and then I got good.
Yeah, you were okay because
I was an okay Braille reader until I discovered Sherlock Holmes, and then I got to be a really good reader.
Because you wanted to read those books.
Yeah, that was just unreal.
Yeah, that's weird because I just finished. I didn't make it all the way through, but there's a big talking book. I think it's 20. Let's see. It was 6 in one and 4 in the other. So that's 10. Let's see. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's 10 cassettes. So that's 40 sides.
Uh-huh.
Supposedly the complete collection of Sherlock Holmes. I made it through about 24 sides maybe, and then I got enough. I had enough. But you read them all.
I think so. Over the years, I mean, I started reading those when I was 13, and I think I finally got through the rest of them when I was maybe 22 or 3.
And that made you into a good Braille reader. That's funny.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. I love it. See, you just fell in love with those mysteries in a way.
My mom introduced me to all kinds of other mystery writers at the time, and I couldn't get enough.
Yeah, and at that time, that most of that stuff wasn't available, I guess, on those old vinyl records. They hadn't read it yet for us.
Yeah, I don't know. They might have not. They wanted to make sure I was a good Braille reader.
And that was one way to do it.
Yeah. They discovered mm-hmm. I loved mysteries, it was,
yeah.
That was it.
And this was the Minnesota School for the Blind?
Yeah, its formal name at that time was the Minnesota Braille and Sight Saving School, which is a rather interesting concept.
Sight Saving. Minnesota Braille and Sight Saving.
Yeah, there were print guys there. And they had the idea that if, you know, it was sort of a use it or lose it concept. And if they thought if they kept these people reading print and got them the right glasses and stuff, that they'd you know, be able to get through life better and all that kind of stuff, I guess.
And in some cases, that's true.
Yeah.
In many. And so are they in a dormitory situation like the rest of us?
Yeah.
What did you think about School for the Blind? Did you like it? Did you learn to hate it? Did you grow?
Oh,
you know?
After about the first 4 years of being eternally homesick, and once I sort of accepted the fact that this is how it really was, that I was going to be there, and got more hardened to it, I got used to it. And then when I was in high school, I was into rock and roll, and the rest of my family was more sedate. And after my voice changed, they stopped beating up on me at school because now I was a big kid and mm-hmm. I could beat up on other people and all that. And so once that happened, I actually enjoyed my last few years there. I had a great time because I could play music loud and do all the pranks and stuff that I like doing. Around home, it was so quiet and sedate, which, you know, I can understand why, but I actually enjoyed that. Then college was a real letdown because I was supposed to be. Now I was supposed to be serious, you know.
But you were old enough to remember when there wasn't rock and roll.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. I can remember when we had two kinds of music. We had what they called hillbilly or country, what we call country now, and of course there was always jazz. But then there was pop.
Yeah.
You know, Perry Como, Bing Crosby.
That crowd.
That all those big bands and big chords and.
And what I remember. Really well, there was this coming soon and all this kind of stuff, and they talked about the new WDGY and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. And on February 7th, 1956, a million zillion stations all over the country became rock stations, and we went nuts.
Really?
It was a Monday morning, and we turned the radio, and everybody's running to every room. Turn on the WDGY, man, this is really weird.
And they were playing Elvis Presley.
All of a sudden, it was these. We got the tops, 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 and all the electronic echoes and stuff, and it was Elvis and every all these records that we had sort of heard a few of every. And now we had this station that played nothing but. We're going, wow.
Nothing but. Now, what date was this again?
February 7th of of 56.
Of 56. And you say that stations all, that this was some sort of magic day.
Yeah, I think so, because we started looking over the dial and we found a bus that used to be, you know, this is Charlie Boone in the afternoon. All of a sudden they were playing this stuff. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder, I'm going to do some research on that to see if that... If that was some agreement that there was at several stations, would
yeah,
you?
I don't
yeah.
know. It was quite an amazing.
But it was wonderful to have that rock and roll.
Yeah.
Hi everybody, we're having a big time now, and they talked after every record they talked.
Yep.
And they you're listening to the brand new WGBH or whatever it was. That big long jingles.
Yeah, they had tons of those. Yeah.
Long involved jingles and the weather was a big deal. Then you know what
yeah.
I mean you know. They read the news differently than they ever had.
Yeah.
Either 2020 news or news on the hour and half hour and you know. Yeah. That was my radio. I lived it, breathed it, ate it, slept it. I loved it so much.
Yeah, we all did.
All right, so we have you. You say you could play music loud. What do you play? What did you play then? Guitar?
No, I didn't play it much. I was playing in the school band. I just liked the fact that nobody but us teenagers has listened to this stuff. It was, you know, we had our own culture. But as far as what I did musically, I played alto horn and later on baritone horn in the school band, but I never took music seriously at that time. I didn't take music seriously until way into college.
But you said you could play music loud. You meant crank the radio up loud.
We had lots of instruments around the house, and we all took music lessons, and I always had perfect pitch and stuff like that. And so, you know, I always knew how to play all these instruments. It's just I never thought of music as something I would emphasize. It was just one of the things in life that was there that I could sort of do, but, you know, I had no idea of what I'd do for a career. I never thought about it. I just kind of banged along through life and waited to see what would happen. I was very passive-aggressive, as they would call it now. I just did what they told me to do, and when they weren't telling me to do, I played with the tape machine and edited tapes and made funny noises and stuff like that.
But you had perfect pitch, and you knew it.
Oh yeah, I knew it.
You knew you had perfect pitch, and you maybe not consciously, but in the back of your mind, you knew I can learn to play anything I want to, anytime I want to. So what's the point in doing it now? I'll do it when I get ready.
Maybe just never. I think of myself as having been a very shallow person then. I all I wanted was to get through the next day without being beat up and. Listen to a couple of rock tunes, eat the food, get through the next day, and wait till some direction either presented itself. I, you know, do the piano tuning. That was there were two courses in school I liked. I liked piano tuning and I liked typing. The rest of it, I just thought, okay, we got to get through this. I don't know why, but as long as I'm alive, in order to keep the criticism down and the static away, I got to get these grades, I got to do this work, okay, fine, that's good. That was sort of my attitude. We'll just schlep on through.
And read Sherlock Holmes,
yeah.
And that's pretty much it.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right, but you became... did you become passionate about radio? Did you think of that's maybe something I'd like to do?
No, not really.
Not really? You just liked it?
I spent a lot of time at the radio station because I liked all the equipment. So I was a ham radio operator, and that I did. I enjoyed that a lot. I liked electronic stuff, you know.
Well, you say that you were just a kind of a get-byer. Seemed like, to me, you had a lot of good interest. I mean,
I was forced to do a lot of things that I ended up liking. Let's put it that way. I wouldn't have taken them up on my own. Ham radio, I sort of did, though. When I saw somebody's ham set, I thought, now there is something really cool. And I actually got my brother interested, and we got our licenses and stuff. But that was the only time I ever took any initiative on anything. The rest of it I just did because I guessed I had to or something
like that. So you played the horn in the band a little bit and listened to the radio, read your mysteries, did ham radio, and made it through somehow high school in the required 12 years.
Yeah.
Got out of high school, and that summer came, you had to make some decisions then.
They sent me to college. I mean, I guess you know, Kathy's always amazed that I didn't take more of this on myself, but I just wasn't the type. I didn't know what I wanted. Well, I knew what I wanted. Before I went to college, at the end of my senior year, a bunch of us roommates decided one wonderful spring night that we were going to go up to Minneapolis, get an apartment, find some menial jobs, enough to make our rent and stuff, and have a beer party at night and just have a good time. And I thought that sounded like a wonderful plan.
And a wonderful way to spend the rest of your life.
I did. I thought that was probably worth it. And so I presented it in the best light I could think of to my parents. And basically they said, well, we're glad that you're thinking of the future and stuff, but we think college would prepare you better for ba-da-da-da-da. And I thought, oh, hell. I have to study. I didn't have to study in high school, you know. It was too easy, but I knew enough about college that I was going to have to study or something.
You also knew that you're still sort of under the umbrella of your parents, and that if that's what they wanted you to do, that's what you're going to have to do.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
That first year was depressing.
You guys from Minnesota. It's wonderful. I love this. Okay, so you went to college, and what did you think you wanted to study? Did you have to declare a major then or anything?
Not my freshman year. I asked my mom. I said, so what do you think? I mean, I'm going to college. What am I? I don't know. I don't know what I'm interested in. What should I major in? And she said, well, you seem to be fascinated by people. Why don't you think about psychology? And I thought, okay.
All right.
Yeah, I like people. I like weird people and stuff. So I took Psych 101 and did miserably at it. It was so boring. They didn't talk about anything that interesting. And all I did after each test was went out and got drunk because I knew I hadn't done very well. And I thought, boy, this is great psychology. And it was the next summer, the summer of 60, which was sort of an interesting turning point. Two things happened, of which this interview sort of depends. One was, there was one day I was lying on my bed. It was hot, and I didn't know anybody very much in our hometown because I hadn't spent that much time there, and I was bored. And I'm lying there. It's hot. My dad came up and asked me what I was doing, and I was just sleeping. I don't know. And he said something like, you know, you don't seem very interested in stuff. Is there anything you'd particularly like to do? And, you know, I'd come out with just below a 2-point grade point average for my freshman
just
year.
Just above the being asked to leave.
Yeah, just above.
Okay.
And so he says, is there anything you'd like to do? And in my drowsy state of mind, I said, I want to fix typewriters. And I thought, hey, now there's an idea. And he said, well, you know, that would take a fair amount of training, and I think by the time the summer's over, you'd be ready to at least be sort of an apprentice, and then you got to start college again. And my thought was, okay, fine, that's not going to work. I guess I'll just go back to sleep. Bye. Meanwhile, I was taking French and all these other things, so they got me a new typewriter that summer that I still have. It's this fantastic machine. But anyway, the other thing that happened was we went to the movie Psycho.
Okay.
After being totally startled by the shower scene, that night I'm lying awake trying to figure out, why was that so scary? And I thought, now, can you remember that sound? And I thought, yeah, I think I can, but it scares the hell out of me to think of it. I thought, yeah, but you're not alone. Your brother's in the bunk below. Come on, let's see if you can do this. So I started slowly trying to think through this sound and got used to being scared again. I thought, okay, what's that made out of? And I start analyzing the sound as to how they did it and what it was. And the longer I did this, you know, I thought, maybe what you ought to be is a music major, because you wouldn't have to study that hard, and you like music and all that. And you'd like to know if there aren't some rules. How do these people know that would scare you that much? Are there rules for this? How do you know how this stuff works? And I thought, you know, this could be really cool. So that night is when I decided to be a music major, and that just changed the whole world.
But that's awful late in life to come to that, as far as I'm...
I'm a late bloomer generally.
Obviously, yes. Basically what we're thinking is, how did they know that that chord they made was going to be a scary chord and was going to scare the bejesus out of you?
Yeah, and I wanted to know... And little did I know that next year, I took the course in contemporary classical music, and that was like all the lights coming on. That just, now I knew where I was going, and there I'd never looked back.
And we had a direction.
Yep.
All right. Well, we have your feet on the ground. Let's take a little quick break and come back in just a minute and talk about the life of Jay Williams on Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr. Hang on. Be right back.
Hi, my name's Donna, and for the past 5 years, I've lived up here in the cold country, Rochester, Minnesota. I'd love to move
Love
to a warmer
is
place,
Blind,
but, you know,
the audio magazine
you know
for singles.
To find. Anyway, I'm around 32 years old, give or take a couple of years, and never been married. Oh, come close once or twice, but things just didn't work out.
If you'd like more information about this exciting new magazine, phone toll-free 1-877-222-0679. That's 1-877-222-0679. Or you can receive the same information as an email. Our address is loveisblind, all one word, at blindlikeme.com. That's loveisblind at blindlikeme.com. Blind Science. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Science, here's Tim Cummings.
Many people who go on vacation decide to document their vacations by taking pictures. Now, for many of us blind and visually impaired people, taking pictures isn't necessarily a fun thing to do, or something that we'd be interested in, at least for ourselves. But how about making audio recordings of your vacations? I've done this in the past, and it's a lot of fun. And today, the website that I'm going to send you to talks about making recordings of your vacation. The website is called quietamerican.org, and there's a section on there where you can actually hear clips of people who've recorded their vacations in different countries. 1 minute recordings of snapshots of vacations. It's a very interesting site, particularly if you listen to some of these clips using headphones. It really makes you feel like you are there. The webmaster talks about the kind of equipment that you'd need to record to make good recordings, and he even offers a link to let you upload your own recordings of your own vacation to the website. The website again is quietamerican.org. The link is www.quietamerican.org, O-R-G. I would give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And for Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights. Segment two, Jay Williams from, as you say, Port Angeles, Washington.
Yep.
Little town of 18,000 people, married to Kathy. Middle name is Seven. I love it. Williams, who is on our blind handyman list, and we've gotten him into second year of college, and you changed majors in midstream. No? Yes?
It was about the right time. Most people didn't declare a major. I went to Beloit College in Wisconsin. People didn't usually choose a major till their sophomore year, or at least you didn't have to.
And you started the classical music training program.
Yeah.
Running scales, learning.
Well, I already knew that part, but there again, I just did it because that was what I was supposed to do, and I could do it, and so I did it. And so by the time I actually decided to be a music major, I already had most of that down. It was, you know, I knew music theory just because I'd listened to music all my life, and all of a sudden I realized, oh, I already know half this crap. Oh, okay, so yeah, I don't need to study. I already know most of this.
So, cool. So you knew what made a major chord a diminished or a seventh or a minor?
Yeah, I knew all that.
You knew all that already?
Yeah.
So that puts you a few steps ahead of your sighted brethren,
yeah.
Maybe. Because you, and besides that, you had perfect pitch.
Yeah.
So away we go. What do you have to declare an instrument? Do you have to decide which instrument you want to focus on?
I don't remember how that went, because by then I'd already fallen in love with playing trombones, and so I was a trombone player. I took that up the summer after high school and decided I really liked playing trombones. So I was a trombone player, and we all had to take piano lessons anyway, because they figured that if you're going to be a musician, you have to be able to do something on a keyboard.
That's true.
Yeah.
We all, you know, every musician in the world knows that.
Yeah.
You need to know a little keyboard so that you know that if you're singing in C and that's too low, that the next progression would be C sharp or D.
Yeah.
So you've got sense enough to know that. So away we went in music. No more of this psychology crap.
Nope.
Out of that, into music.
Yeah.
Then and on. So you got a degree. Was this a 2-year college you were at, or four-year?
No, 4-year.
A 4-year college.
I got my Bachelor of Arts.
They could give you a BA in music.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, that puts you at age 22 or 23 or something.
Yeah.
And then
I went to Indiana University.
To get a master's.
Yeah. Were I to do it over again, I would have gone straight for the PhD, but my then great wisdom of the time said, no, get a master's and then decide what you were going to do. And that caused all kinds of static in terms of, I had as my goal that time to be a university teacher and all that. And that really wasn't the best way of going about it. But in the long run, I'm glad it didn't work out, because I'm glad I didn't end up being a university teacher.
But you were a kind of a closet rock and roller. Trombone doesn't fit that. They don't use...
Well, I liked rock and roll just because it was a teenage thing to like. But once I got into music, my real interest is... My primary interest is classical music, because it's so involved, and it really involves... It really totally involves me. And very close to that is jazz. I play a lot of jazz because I like improvising and all that. But in terms of actually listening, I find classical music to be the greatest adventure of them all. It's like reading novels. It's involving. There's so much going on. I like pop music in terms of how it reflects the culture and all that, but it doesn't involve my whole mind. It's just kind of, okay, you know, tell me more, you know. Classical music, to me, it's got everything.
What you're basically saying is 1-4-5 is a little boring.
Not the 1-4-5, it's just, in a pop song, you only have just so long to convey a message.
Uh-huh.
And the message, you know, sometimes is very profound, even.
Mm-hmm.
But classical music is like reading a big novel. You go into this adventure that you know is going to go on for a while, and it's going to get complicated, and it may end up being very sad. It may be very heartbreaking even, but it's still beautiful. It may be very ugly and intense. I mean, modern classical music, there is nothing more intense than that.
It may have some happy moments and some sad moments, like
yeah,
a book, like a novel.
Especially anybody who's listened to the Stravinsky Rite of Spring knows that there is no more intense music ever than that, which is why it caused riots when it came out, is because it is so intense.
But you do enjoy improv, jazz. You do enjoy jazz.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we got you. You went and got this PhD.
I ended up with a master's degree, and by then I got interested in electronic music. So I ended up being a grad assistant teaching electronic music at Indiana. And
you were still in Minnesota at this time.
No, I was in Indiana.
You'd moved to Indiana.
Essentially, yeah.
Which isn't far, is it, really?
What, 600,
yes.
800 miles?
Well, you know, but...
Culturally, it's a whole other world.
Oh, is it?
Culturally, that That was quite a change.
See, us poor Texans, we 600 or 800 miles isn't that's it's
right.
More than 800 miles across the state. So we think of that's just a we go that far for supper.
Yeah, but pretty much.
So you moved. How did you get to your folks moved to Indiana? Or you went on your own?
I just went to school there, and I stayed there so long that basically I lived there.
And became home.
Yeah.
And so you were teaching electronic music as in keyboarding, as in...
back then we had synthesizers that had keyboards, but the only way you could do this kind of music was to record stuff on a track of tape and then record your next sound or next group of sounds and mix them all together. There synthesizers back in the late 60s, early 70s, It would take a while to describe, but they aren't like anything people nowadays use. It was a very, very primitive but wonderful thing to work with because everything had to be stored on audio tape.
On cassette.
You were probably never going to, whatever sound you got that you liked, you probably weren't going to ever get that sound again.
So,
and remember, this isn't pop style music. This is very... it's hard to describe because there aren't that many people out there that really know what this music is like. But there are some composers like Karlheinz Stockhausen and people like that are sort of the models for those of us in sort of classical electronic music.
Now, you were working with a multi-track recorder or working...
Those studios were wonderful. We had several multi-track recorders.
As in two-track or four-track?
Four-track, mostly four-track.
Mostly four-track machines.
Yeah.
So you would do something on track one and do something on track two and track three and then mix them all together on four, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, eventually you'd mix it all down. And I sat there trying to run a Braille stopwatch and a 10-channel mixer all at the same time because some of these various sounds had to come in and go out at various times. And when there wasn't sound, all you would get is hiss. And so to minimize hiss, you wanted to turn up and down the gain on these sounds if they weren't there. And that was an interesting trick to sit there watching a stopwatch going, well, now I know at 8 minutes 30 seconds I've got to bring up sound on channel 10, you know.
And you were mixing all this to a cassette.
No.
Or to a...
audio tape.
To an actual reel-to-reel.
Oh, yeah.
Audio tape.
This is serious stuff. You don't store things on cheap little cassette. You store this at 15 or 30 inch per second on the best tape you can get.
Okay, but four tracks is all we had, all you had then. It was four. Four tracks.
We had several four-track machines. I think we had three of them, and then we had three two-track machines for mixdown. And other stuff. We had lots of interesting stuff in that studio.
And a 10-channel mixing console.
Yeah, we had two of those. Four-channel, 10-channel in, 4-channel out.
Okay. So this is much like my experience with radio production. It's like it, but I wasn't doing the same thing, but I was working with the same kind of stuff.
Yeah, same stuff, same equipment.
I remember when I bought a two-track Ampex in 1964, brand new. It's called a PR-10. I thought I had died and gone to heaven because I could then do music on one track and voice on the other track and mix them together.
Uh-huh.
Or I didn't want to do stereo. I just wanted to be able, and then I could do something on one. People talk about where they were when John Kennedy died. I can tell you where I was. I had two Webcore tape recorders, and I was doing a jingle for Shep's Little Chicken Shack in Texas City, bouncing stuff. Did the bass, then I added rhythm guitar, then I added two or three vocals, and then I added a lead and bouncing it back and forth and trying not to lose the original, you know?
Yep.
Which is, you've done some of that, I'm sure. Where you ping pong tracks back and forth.
Yeah.
Okay, so this music that you were creating was for what purpose? For what to be used for what?
It was for the same purpose of Beethoven or any. This is classical, quote art music unquote. You compose it because that's what it's in. Because you're driven to do it. And if it gets published or put on record, fine. If it doesn't, that's okay, too. you'll play it for like-minded friends who also like that kind of music. You don't make money at this stuff unless you become a university professor and make money at teaching, and you know, but nobody ever made their living at composing that kind of music.
And you were a university professor at this time?
Well, sir, I was a grad assistant.
Okay, where did they, at some college, somebody taught you how to do this audio stuff, or how did you get that? How did you get there? Could you take courses in that?
I didn't. I'd played with tape with equipment all my life, and being a ham radio operator, it's no big jump to look at a bunch of equipment and turn knobs and go, oh, that's how this works. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, back then you could do that.
Yeah.
Because it was all physical stuff back then.
Yeah, there was no menus.
Yeah, and there was also no board that would automatically fade the pot down to prevent that hiss. You had
right.
to physically
you had
hand
to do, you had to
do
every
do this.
Motion. Yep.
Okay. Then this thing you were doing was the job you had was gone because technology passed it.
Well, being the loose cannon I was tuning pianos to earn my keep at Indiana.
Okay.
And while I took all these courses, I'd long given up on the doctorate by then. I was just taking these courses and teaching and having a high old time and keeping body and soul together by tuning pianos. Then they decided to fire me from the piano tuning job because I was growing a beard. This is late 1970. And about that time, I was offered a piano tuning job at the North Carolina School of the Arts, and my survival skills said you better take it, and so I did.
They fired you from the piano tuning job.
Yeah, because I was growing a beard, and they thought that put forth a message that the university at that time at Indiana didn't want to put out, and all that. So before they could fire me, I resigned. I didn't want being fired on my record at that time. So I resigned and took this other job.
But you were having great fun teaching there and playing with the recording equipment.
I was having a fantastic time.
And you weren't drinking any at all, were you? Of course not. No.
In that sense. I mean, I love my social drink and stuff. But
you'd given up beer drinking as a profession by then.
Yeah,
I've been there.
Yeah. No, I took it up right. later when I was in San Francisco, but that's a whole other story.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I may take it up tomorrow. But they offered you a piano tuning job in North Carolina.
Yep.
And man, you've had a ride. I love every minute of it.
That was great too. I loved that. That was an amazing place.
So North Carolina, but they didn't have any. Did they have a studio to play in or not?
No. So I had to build my own, and get some people around me who are interested, and we didn't get a program going at that school as such, but what we ended up doing was an artist-in-residence program at all the junior high schools in the county. And for that, we got this grant, and we bought a whole bunch of equipment, and I and this assistant went around to the different schools setting up tape machines and mixers and doing some of the craziest stuff. I mean, get 13-year-old kids with cassette machines and tape machines and mixers together, and oh my, it was some of the wildest stuff you ever heard.
Really? These were music major kids, or
no? They were just junior high kids
that wanted to have a good time, and
we decided to introduce them to contemporary art, and they had poets come in, they had painters, and so I was doing electronic music, and the kids liked it so much that. The program got renewed, and we got all this equipment and had them do their own pieces.
Wow.
It was insane.
But you were still being forced to tune pianos to make your livelihood.
Oh, yeah, that was fine, because I was good at it, you know, and they appreciated it. I was certainly appreciated.
Yeah, and the banging of piano tuning never got on your nerves. It doesn't bother you.
Oh, no.
No, okay. All right. Well, so we're up to the late 70s, and you're in North Carolina, long way from home, Minnesota boy. And carry on. How did that ended?
That's a story about where I burned some unnecessary bridges and da 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 da. I don't need to recount that. That would take another hour. But basically, I finally realized my other dream, my long-held dream, which was to live in San Francisco. So I left North Carolina and moved out to San Francisco, partly just because I was tired of going on other people's coattails. I wanted to know what would happen if I moved to some place on my own without prior references. I needed to find out what was really important to me, what really mattered. It was one of those midlife crisis bits.
So moving out there, this is without a job, without anything, just I'm going to take a flight or a bus or whatever.
A bus.
To San Francisco.
I couldn't afford a flight.
So you busted out to San Francisco.
I did.
And got there and found some hole to sleep in.
Actually, it was pretty good. I knew of some people through a friend, and they called them up and said that there was this blind guy going to come out, and would they mind if I hung out for a week or two or whatever till I found an apartment? They said no. And so at least I had a place to hang my hat or whatever it was I was going to hang, and to see and within 4 days I had three or four piano tuning jobs, and I thought, okay, we can make this work. And so I ended up moving there and stayed there for 16 years.
Now, you piano tuning jobs, where did you go, to churches or schools or what, to find?
Churches, schools, people's houses. One of my jobs was at a music instrument rental place where they couldn't find anybody who knew how to tune Fender Rhodes pianos. And I could tune a Fender Rhodes piano, so they were very glad to have me on the scene.
I didn't realize they were tunable. I mean, I guess I know about Fender Rhodes, but and you could tune them. I mean, the basic temperament you set would be the same, but the physical knowing how was the deal, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of hard tuning those high notes, because moving the little things around along those rods, they're little. So the slightest motion changes the tuning by quite a bit.
Okay. But you mastered that, and you could tune a Fender Rhodes piano.
Yeah, I figured, I knew how, I'd seen the insides, I knew how they worked, so I figured I could tune it. I'd never tuned one before I got there, and I got there, and I thought, yeah, okay, I can tune this.
And so the guy asked you, can you tune a Fender Rhodes? And I said, oh, yeah, of course I can, but you'd never tuned one before.
No, but I knew I could.
God, I love it. Listen, I'll be out. I'm going to catch a plane and come out there. This is great that you had that much nerve.
I had to live.
You had to eat.
I was in state of shock at what the rents and things were like after North Carolina. I'm going, we better make money real fast.
You had to eat. Got blind guys, and I guess other people too. You do whatever you have to do to eat. So you stayed there 14 years.
Stayed there 16
years.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, there wasn't a Kathy then.
No.
You were on your own. And you had no one to be responsible for except Jay Williams.
Yep.
Which sometimes is good if you're going to.
It was very good. It was because I had a lot of searching to do, it was in San Francisco where I finally ended up working at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute. I'd always thought making a living at electronics would be really cool. And so I entered their they had a training program going there to see if they could teach blind folks how to solder and do all that. And I could and did and wouldn't leave, so I got a job there.
So they just hired you?
Yep, because I wouldn't go away, and I was building all this stuff. And eventually the job ended up, it was so cool, I got it accepted into a grant that not only was I an electronics technician building all these measuring devices, but it also got into the grant that I would be doing research on accessible music software. And so on my workbench, I had soldering equipment and all that, the associated stuff, and a computer and a synthesizer. Now tell me it doesn't get better than that.
It doesn't get better than that, sir.
No, that was okay.
How much soldering could you do? Could you a good bit?
I mean, yeah. I still do. I like soldering. It's fun.
And if you're going to solder two wires together, just tell me how you do that. I want to solder two wires together. I want to solder a wire on a battery terminal.
Just wrap the wire around it. Make sure it's that it's clean and that the insulation's gone. I wrap the solder around a little bit and put a little solder on top, take the soldering iron and feel with the back of my fingers where the heat is so I have an idea of how close I really am. And after a while, you know, the soldering iron's a white cane. You know how long it is. You know about where your hand ought to be so the tip comes close to it. Then you just bring the tip and hit the solder, and, you know, you'll feel it kind of disappear, and just take the tip away, and it's soldered.
And it's melted.
Yep.
I've tried it, but it's been a long time, I guess, because I've met several people now who can do it, so obviously I could do it.
It takes practice. I mean, it's amazing how many solder joints you and how many fingers fail in the process, but I knew I wanted to do it, so I just figured, okay, this is going to take a lot of practice, and I spent my time in the training program just soldering, you know, learning to solder it. I didn't worry about how long it took or any. I just decided I'm going to do this, and I don't care whether I fail the first 500 times or not. I'm not even going to count that.
I'm going to do it.
I'm just simply going to do this and watch and see how it progresses. I just figured it would be an interesting thing to watch how it worked. You know.
Now, what did they think they could? They were training blind people to solder. Yeah, but what? How did they think that was going to help you? Or others, blind people?
Well, they figured there's probably a lot of us out there who'd like to at least be able to fix our patch cords or, you know, replace battery terminals and do basic stuff on electronic equipment that we all had. And the guys figured, wouldn't it be nice if you could at least do some of this yourself instead of always having to rely on somebody else?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically it was just a life skill they were teaching you. They weren't trying to teach you this to help you make a living.
There was no particular goal in mind. I mean, they figured if you came into the training program, you could go as far as you want. And some of our trainees did end up getting jobs because of that training. Others never quite learned it and at least learned for themselves that there were some things they probably weren't cut out to do, and that was okay, too.
Yeah, well, sure it was. Okay, Smith Kettlewell, and you stayed there as a teacher for a good while.
Yeah, I was managing the training program, and I was a technician. I was there for, 13 years.
Well, we've gotten you, you're getting a little long in the tooth now. And so how did you get you from San Francisco to where?
Met Kathy. We got married. She was living in Ogden, Utah, and the kids were there. The house was there. So I moved there.
You moved there?
Yeah.
Sight unseen. That wasn't a very good pun, and I didn't mean it. But how did her living in Utah and you living in, how did you meet? How did you?
She came out to the National ACB convention in '93.
And you met her there?
Yeah.
Okay, and so you decided I'll move to Utah where she is.
Yeah, Jessica, she tried for some jobs in the Bay Area, but the salaries and the cost of living were nothing like the same ratio in Utah. And anyway, the kids were there in Utah. And they had their friends and stuff, and I was tired of San Francisco summers. I was willing to risk the cultural change going to Utah.
When you say the kids, you mean her kids?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you moved to Utah?
Yep.
Okay. Quieter, slower pace, less hassle, got to find a job.
It was very different.
But it was.
I still ended up, I was an adjunct faculty member at the state university, the Weber State College in Ogden, and I got back into really being a musician again there. She took me over to the college, and we went by the practice rooms, and I thought, God, I can't believe that I stopped playing trombone on a regular basis for so long. Why did I stop all this? And so I credit her with getting me back into music as a real profession.
And after all, we're losing sight of the fact that you were highly degreed and highly qualified to teach.
Yeah, and I'd let that pass. When I got to San Francisco, one thing led to another, and I ended up in electronics. And I play for company parties and stuff, but I composed a lot of electronic music using computers, but I didn't do much actual trombone playing.
But now we're in Utah, and this college hired you as a professor. Hired you
as a trombone teacher, and I was playing in their concert bands and stuff like that.
Yeah, and glad to have you, weren't they?
I guess because I was a blind, freaky guy, and you know, they just thought, what? They treated me like I was from some other planet. We don't know how he does this, but hey, the guy can play a trombone and he can memorize it. And see, he can follow the conductor. We don't know how he does it, but hey, isn't that cool?
It is pretty darn cool. You alluded to the fact that you had done a lot of radio.
In North Carolina, I had a contemporary classical music show on every Monday night for about 3 years.
On the local FM?
On the Wake Forest University station.
Because that was back when that's what you did on FM. That's what FM stations did.
Yeah.
Back then was play classical long-haired music. And every Monday night you'd come in and do this classical. So you learned to sort of be a radio announcer. Did you run the board?
I actually made my tapes at home. I didn't have a license. I didn't have a commercial license.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, I had way better equipment at home than they did. So I did the I did the show it at my own house.
So
and
you
just brought the tapes over there.
You did it on reel to reel at 7.5 and took it to them.
Yep.
And they threaded it up and ran it every month.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was your experience in radio, but
yeah.
you never worked, you never did a commercial
no.
radio. Well, you're just as well off that you didn't. Okay. So we're in Utah now
I was there for 5 years and, then when our kids graduated, so did our transportation and the bus service was getting worse. And Kathy especially was looking for some place with not quite such hot summers and not such cold winters. And we wanted some place where we could drink coffee again, where we could get good coffee. We both like coffee, basically. And her mother mentioned the Northwest up in Washington. Why didn't we look there? So she looked on the web and looked at a few towns around here. And to make a story short, we decided Port Angeles, having a symphony and all this great arts community, might be a place to look. So 5 years ago this month, we came up here, and in 4 days we bought a house. And the rest is history.
So the kids were gone. Transportation was gone. No bus service. So you just moved without any reason, rhyme or reason, other than you thought you'd like it, to Port Angeles, Washington.
Yeah, basically. And we love it here. It's great. We're both thriving.
You've got a lot of nerve. I'll have to give you. I've done a few things like that, but with great feelings of trepidation.
Well, there's always that, but there's also the thing of you look at what possibly lies in the future, and that kind of there wasn't a lot of especially now that she wasn't supporting the kids in the same way at least, you know.
Yeah.
They were out of school and going on their own. There really wasn't much left for us in Utah. There wasn't much of a future for me there or for her.
And there wasn't much coffee.
Well, there wasn't that either.
Wow.
I mean, we were cultural outsiders. She had joined the predominant church there because that was the game in town, and the kids, you know, and the kids were there. And that was the game in town. If you wanted to be a part of society, you joined that.
You joined the Mormon. You became a Mormon.
She had become a Mormon. I never did. And,
yeah.
So she joined the church, but that doesn't mean that she was, you know, she's not a member of the church up here.
But it was more for social reasons than...
It was social and to get any kind of connections going.
See, if we could just get most people who join churches to admit what you just admitted, we'd be a hell of a lot better off in this world.
Probably.
But that's neither here nor there. So Port Angeles, Washington, 5 years. All right, what are you doing now? What is Jay Williams like now?
I'm tuning pianos here. I've got more music. I have to turn down music gigs. I've got more gigs than I'll ever know what to do with. I'm teaching jazz singers and improvisers up at the junior college here, and I'm playing in two or three combos and organizing temporary combos for various functions. that's mostly it. And Kathy does a lot of volunteer work here, and she's on various committees and stuff like that.
So now, are you doing all this as a trombonist, or do you have some other? You play some keyboard?
Mostly as a trombonist.
Okay.
Just got a new horn that I love.
And you say you turn down music gigs.
Yeah, I can't do them all, but I'm in great demand, as a matter of fact.
What kinds of music gigs? Private parties or club dates or what kinds of?
Yeah, a little of each. I play in the local symphony, too, and so, there's some classically oriented dates that occasionally I have to turn down because they conflict with some other gig that I've already committed to.
So you're as busy now as you want to be.
Yeah.
I am
pretty busy. I'm on various committees. They do a lot of music in the schools up here, and I'm on committees where we audition people for scholarships and stuff like that.
Do you have a home studio?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's computer-based?
Oh, yeah.
And you're using SoundForge or GoWave or
what? I'm using CoolEdit.
CoolEdit.
Yeah.
Made by Minnetonka?
Made by Centrillium, I think. But they've now sold out. They're now Adobe.
Okay.
Adobe Audition, I think, is the newest.
CoolEdit. Now, is this a multi-track program or two-track, or what is?
It's a multi-track thing. The multi-track part isn't all that accessible, but that doesn't matter to me. I can do two tracks on top of two tracks and get them mixed together. I can make it happen without worrying about the multi-track.
Well, yeah, with digital, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to lose anything no matter what you do with it. That's the beauty of when they finally gave us recordable CDs and stuff. You just, Rhapsody. Are you familiar with Rhapsody?
Yeah.
Rhapsody is this great music service offered by somebody, by Real Player. And they say, for $10 a month, you can listen to anything you want, but you can't burn it to CD unless we let you. Well, I just tied a DAT machine to my computer.
Exactly.
And so I can burn anything I want. How are they going to stop me? So for $10 a month, I've got 800,000 tunes in my computer. 800,000. I just like saying that. I'm sorry.
But anyway, before we run out of time, though, I'd mentioned that I collect old typewriters.
We never touched that.
Yeah, and the thing is, back in typing class was one of my favorite classes in school, and I've always liked the machines just as machines, regardless of the fact that they liberate us from having to dictate sighted folks and stuff and allow us to do college. They allowed us college papers.
Yeah.
But I just always liked the machines, and I always knew from the first time I ever saw a couple of really old ones, I thought, don't you dare ever even think about collecting them, because this would be an unstoppable virus if there ever was one. Well,
it is.
It is. And ever since the time Kathy and I were down at Salvation Army or something, and she said, oh, look, they have an old Royal. I learned on one of these. And I said, oh, so did I. And it was only $5. So I brought it home, and it wasn't working. And I thought, well, it'll be interesting, because I've always wondered what the innards of these things really look like anyway. Well, I got it working, and I thought, how about that? A 1954 Royal, just like we learned on it. Now I can type on it. And it's gone on from there.
You're right. I'm out of time. Give me 3 or 4 weeks, and let me come back, and we'll do 15 or 20 minutes, because I've got a couple other things that I need to do short show on.
Yeah, and you can edit this.
And I can edit this, and let me come back to you in a month or so, and we'll do 15 or 20 minutes on your typewriter and typewriter collection. Would that be cool?
Yeah.
Jay Williams, you've had a most interesting life, sir, and my hats, my applause, my hats off to you, sir. You're a brave man. Keep up the good work and tell Kathy hello.
I will. No, I'm just a loose cannon is all. And once a cannonball's out of the barrel, it's going to go wherever. That's me.